So for this evening, I'd like to speak a little bit about maturity and about the idea of a personal growth, development. This is something which we perhaps don't encounter so often, or perhaps so explicitly taught. When we look at the abstract teachings of the Dhamma, such as, for example, the Eightfold Path or the Bhojangas that we've just recited, and these simply talk about the development of particular qualities. And of course, in accordance with the anatta teaching, that there's no need to bring a self into it. But if we look at those teachings on development and consider them, then we see that very often they are in fact talking about the same kinds of things that we mean more generally when we're talking about personal development or personal maturity. The reason I want to bring this up and raise it to you for as a something to reflect on is because it seems to me that sometimes in Buddhism that we can become so caught up in developing a meditation method and developing a technique or a particular practice that we forget to look around and realize that actually what kind of person am I becoming. And sometimes we can see people who can develop particular practices for many years and apparently seem to become quite adept at them to a certain level, and yet there's something missing. There's a lack of balance there, a lack of integration. Now, in terms of how humans, sentient beings, mature and grow and develop as we grow, of course, this is a very complex area, and many things that can talk about. But there, I'd just like to present, first of all, a very general model which I think is quite useful and which is quite widely used in psychology and so on. And that is that as we grow older, our mind tends to differentiate. And then with the differentiation, following the differentiation, there comes integration. So what that means is that as we grow up and as we encounter different experiences in life, and this happens at every stage of life, not just when we're young, all stages of life, we encounter new things which demand new responses from us. We need to learn new skills. It might be just a simple thing, a simple practical skill, but more appropriately it means developing, say, new ways of being or relating. And now I'm 42, I'm a middle-aged man. I do things differently and I relate to people differently than when I was 20 or than when I was 15 or whatever. These things change during your life. So as we learn these new skills, in a sense we have to break off a mind. Part of our mind is broken off and develops in a way that's separate or independent. And then those two separate or independent parts of our mind need to learn how to relate to each other. There needs to be communication between them, talking and listening, to each other. If there's no communication, then when the two parts become separate, we call that differentiation. If those two parts don't talk to each other and don't listen to each other, then we call that dissociation. But when you have the two separate parts, which each of them doing their own job, and each of them talking to and listening to the other part, then that's what we call integration. So it's a bit similar to what happens, for example, when we're organizing our monastery. As the monastery goes on and gets older and becomes larger and more complex and more experienced, we gradually become more sophisticated in how the monastery is organized. We have departments, we have offices, we have different people looking after different parts of that monastery, and it's not necessary for everybody to know everything about everything that goes on. But it is necessary that there remains a communication between those different parts. And that's why we have, for example, our community meetings, so that we can talk about things. So it's just like a general model for you on how growth happens. And, of course, the ideas I've presented are fairly simple and fairly general, and I think they're fairly unproblematic, but of course it gets much more complex and much more problematic when we try to work out the specifics of things. So I won't go into that. But what I would like to do is to talk about certain particular issues or junctures which it seemed to me are quite significant and to some extent problematic in the monastic life in particular. And we were talking a little bit about this the other night, and about how sometimes in monasteries or monastic communities that there's a kind of a feeling of it's kind of hard to pin down, but a feeling of anxiety or tension or some kind of a gung-ho attitude or a harshness sometimes. And this kind of harshness in monastic communities, of course, normally manifests around gender issues. And also, if it's not gender issues, then often it's sectarian issues. Or something like that, all of which is, of course, just a kind of, some kind of tribalism. Identifying with your own group and thinking that your own group's better than the others. And so I think it's an interesting thing to consider and to reflect on why that is so and what's going on. I want to just apologize in advance here, because when I'm going to be considering some of these dynamics, especially the gender issues, I'm going to be, I anticipate I'm going to be talking about it mostly from a male perspective, because, well, firstly I am one, and secondly that's my main experience. So try to be inclusive, but I can't promise that I'll be completely inclusive. And also I think that there are some things that I simply understand better about male development than I do about female development. So one of the critical things in a monastery, and this is something which I've noticed through my studies of the stories and the sociology of Buddhism, is that very often boys are sent to a monastery in a way that parallels and substitutes for the initiation rituals which you find in most societies. So I'm sure you're familiar that in most tribal societies and so on, a certain stage of life, the young boys and girls are put through various initiation rituals. And these initiation rituals are somewhat different usually for the boys than for the girls. And the purpose of them, generally speaking, the purpose of them is to bring somebody into adulthood. And the rituals themselves are often very painful and traumatic. They might involve ritual scarring and fasting, various kinds of things that seem very torturous to us. Sometimes for the girls, for example, are put into seclusion for up to, you know, from several days to many years in some cases. But they literally don't see anybody or talk to anybody. So we don't do that anymore. We don't have these kinds of rituals. And so it seems that in Buddhist culture that the ordination period, especially for young boys, has evolved, temporary ordination has evolved as a kind of substitute for these kinds of initiation rituals. Now the basic purpose of these initiation rituals, especially for boys, is to take them out of the sphere of the mother into the sphere of the father. And of course when children are being brought up, typically, and of course this is not an absolute, but as a rule of thumb, typically they're brought up mainly by the women, mainly by the mother. And the father tends to be a bit absent. The father's out working and so on while the mother stays in the home. And at a certain time, the boy crosses over so that they come to be primarily hanging around with the men and initiated into that men's group. And this is one of the basic forms of the initiation. Now that initiation happens, of course, at adolescence. That means that it happens when a boy comes into sexual maturity. And that means that they're moving out of their childhood into their adulthood. They move out from the sphere of the mother. And the very pain and trauma of that separation which is imposed gives us an idea of how difficult it is to achieve that. It's not something we should take for granted. It's not something that's easy. Of course, in contemporary society, because we don't have the accepted rituals for doing this, we usually do it by teenage rebellion, don't we? Get your ear pierced and get a tattoo and grow your hair long and start smoking dope, and then that, you know, gets you out of your... eventually your mum kicks you out of the home or whatever. But this is what we do. We differentiate ourselves through all these means. So that temporary period of separation and differentiation carries out an extremely important function. As the child is growing up, its experience, its primary experience of its mother is and forms largely its experience of the feminine. Especially from the early days, of course it gradually fades away as time goes on, but especially from infancy. Now, at a certain point, that child is going to want to it grows up, becomes an adult and wants to get married. And so they don't want to marry their mother. So there needs to be that breakage, and the feminine, the idea of the feminine in the young boy's mind needs to break off, needs to differentiate, so that we have the mother on one side and on the other side the lover or the wife. And so this is the basic function that this initiation performs. It separates the boy from the mother. It allows him to develop a differentiated perception of the feminine. So that later on he can marry and enter into a relationship with a woman, without dragging his mother issues along into the relationship, which I think we will all agree is a good thing. Right? And this is what, you know, obviously this is a serious problem if this doesn't happen, if a man has not figured out his relationship with his mother and understood this and differentiated it from his relationship with other women, then you're in for all kinds of problems. So this differentiation is very important. But of course that differentiation shouldn't lead to dissociation, shouldn't lead to a complete cutting off and shutting off of these two different aspects of the mind. And so this is a developmental thing, you know, for the boy. Mother is the primary experience of the feminine. At a certain time, this is differentiated. The wife or the lover becomes the primary experience. And then the person grows older. And then, of course, a similar process happens later on when they have children, and maybe they have a daughter. And so again, there's another differentiation that occurs there in a maturing. The mind's becoming more complex. The perception of feminine is becoming more complex. And just as the man knows that having sexual relations with his mother is inappropriate, is wrong, then he would feel the same about having sex with his daughter. And so this is the origin of the incest taboo. And we know that the incest taboo is one of the primary social features of all human society. It's one of the few very truly universal features of human culture. And it's so basic to how human cultures are formed. And it's often seen by anthropologists as the primary force in structuring and creating human culture. And even more than that, when we create, when we have this idea of the incest taboo, what it means is that we've differentiated and distinguished people in our mind, groups of people, with very clear yes and no boundaries between them. And it's quite fascinating if we look at a lot of mythology, and not even mythology, but riddles and stories, that they very often will pivot around these boundaries, questioning them, interrogating them, confusing them. And we see this very often in the old stories. This is something that was always a concern, it's always a worry. Concerns about parentage, concerns about lineage, about understanding who's a relative and who's not, who's kin and who's not. Because these things fundamentally determine what kinds of relationships we can enter into. And are fundamental to our development of a stable human society of any complexity. So notice that these external relationships correspond with internal emotional developments. That the love that a man feels for his mother is different than the love he feels for his wife. And the love he feels for his wife is different and the love he feels for his daughter. It motivates different kinds of behaviors, manifests in different kinds of ways. So as one matures, as one grows older, one's mind settles into, becomes comfortable with more of these different ways of relating, and the structures in one's own emotional responses have become more clear. There's one very important kind of relationship which I haven't mentioned so far, and that's the relationship of a sister, a brother and a sister. And this one is actually, in some ways, quite different than all of the others. Compared to any other kind of human relationship, the relationship of a brother and sister is unique. And that's because it's eternal, in a very deep sense, in a very literal sense. That means that right from the beginning of our life, when we're very young, our brother or our sister has been there. And they're there all through our life, at every stage of our life, until we're old, until we die. So it's the only relationship that happens that doesn't focus on one particular period of our life. You know, when a relationship with a mother tends to be formed mostly in the early years of our life. A relationship with a lover tends, or a wife tends to be formed in the early adult years. A relationship with a daughter or with children tends to form in the middle years and so on. But the relationship with a sister or with a brother is something which is there through our whole life and which changes and evolves gradually in a very mutual way. Now, in talking about these, I'm talking in very general terms, and I'm talking in terms of these, the kind of these archetypal relationships. Of course, in any particular life, may well be quite different. And we may or may not experience many of these things. Sometimes we don't have a mother, our mother's died or been separated from us. Sometimes we don't get married. Sometimes we don't have children. Sometimes we don't have brothers and sisters. So all of these things vary from lifetime to lifetime. But on average and on the whole, that's how these things are. So this is what we mean when we talk about archetypes. Archetype is nothing special, it's not some kind of metaphysical thing, in my understanding. All it means is just the patterns that things tend to happen in over many, many lives. And so even though from one life to the next, things will be different, but over countless lives, and if we're born thousands and thousands and thousands of times, these tend to be the patterns that things happen in. And so it tends to form these very kind of general ways of evolution and development in our mind, which of course get adapted to particular circumstances in each life. And one of the reasons that I was started thinking about this was because we were discussing the other day about the sutta where somebody asks, how do the young monks deal with lust when they come to the monastery, with sexual desire? And then the answer was given that, well, when they meet women, if they're women who are younger than them, they see them as their daughter. If they're the same age, they see them as a sister. And if they're older, they see them as a mother. And then he says, what if that doesn't work? He says, well, if that doesn't work, then contemplate the parts of the body. He says, well, if that doesn't work, then practice sense restraint. So that practice of seeing people in this way, that's the primary practice. And it's the primary practice because it relates to our basic emotional and personal development. It lies before and underneath the more specialized practices that we do as monastics, as renunciates, as meditators. So the practices of, say, contemplating parts of the body, which we do to dispel lust, that's a specific meditation technique which is meant for development of higher states of consciousness. It's not meant to substitute for and replace our ordinary emotional development. And this is, I think, where the problem lies that I mentioned earlier. That in some cases that we actually are in a monastery not because not because we're doing these advanced contemplative practices, but we're doing it in order to sort of incubate and get free from the stresses of life and the family and all of these kinds of things. And so again, my main experience with this has been with the monks. And so again, I apologize for the gender bias that I'm aware of in this talk. But my main experience has been with this. And so there's this escaping from the feminine, from the sphere of the mother, or from the fear of relationship or whatever it might be, into the monastic environment. And then this teaching on relating to women as daughters, as sisters, as mothers is not heard. It's not actually encouraged. I've never heard anybody teach that in a monastery. It's something I just read from the suttas. But what they do teach you is to contemplate the parts of the body and to contemplate the loathsomeness of the body and these kinds of things to dispel lust. And so these kinds of practices are not a substitute for a balanced emotional development. It's just a particular meditation technique which is useful for when developing, encountering certain kinds of problems when developing higher consciousness, that's all. So there's this kind of way that as monastics that we learn to be in a relationship and have a relationship. And again, I just call your attention to that relationship of a brother and sister. And when a brother and sister, I mean, of course, brothers and sisters have all different kinds of relationships. But to me, that kind of relationship has a certain kind of almost like an unquestioning trust. That they've always been there. And that we've known each other, everything about each other, always. We've always known. And so there's no issues and there's no agendas. We're not sort of trying to force, get anything out of the other. But there's a sort of sense of acceptance and just being. Mutual understanding. So this is why when in Jungian psychology, when it talks about the development of the man's development of his feminine side or the woman's development of the masculine side, they talk about the anima or the animus, which is always seen as being closely related to the sister or the brother archetype. It's a figure or female figure or male figure which is the same age or similar age, but it's not a sexual relationship. Because the sexual relationship, of course, is always much more needy. It's always much more grasping. There's that kind of relationship we have as monastics. It doesn't have that neediness. It doesn't have that grasping. And there's a beautiful simile that it gives in the suttas for that. And it talks about having that relationship being like a full moon which glides across the surface of a still pool. And you see the reflection of the moon in the water. So that's a very beautiful image, isn't it? And you know, we can see that the moon itself is very beautiful. It's round, it's glowing, it's full. It doesn't need anything to complete it. The pond itself is beautiful by itself. So cool, still, clear water. It doesn't need anything to complete it. And yet when we happen to see that moon coming across the pond, and we can see the reflection of the moon in the pond, both of them become so much more beautiful. The pond is so much more beautiful than it was before. The moon reflected is so much more beautiful than just the moon by itself. So that relationship between them, which just happens to take place, it makes them both so much more special. It gives a magic to that moment when they're coming when the paths cross. And just as their paths have crossed, the moon slides across the surface of the pool and disappears. Yeah. And notice how humans, notice how we relate to that. If we see that, yeah, you see the pond in the thing, the moon reflected in the pond, immediately you want to grab a camera, don't we? Capture it, freeze it, keep it, make it last. That's our attachment. We want to take that moment and make it last for eternity. But of course that's just changing, isn't it? It just goes on. Or we think about the monastics, would be like the planets in the sky. And of course the planets are always wandering around the sky. They're not fixed in place like the stars are. And also all the stars are in fixed constellations. They always have the same relationship to each other. As the planets wander around from one to the other, now they're in one constellation, now there'll be another. Wherever they go, they make the constellation more beautiful than it was before, more brilliant. And they wander in and out. So this is how, as monastics, that we should relate both to each other and also to people outside the monastic community, the lay people and so on. Neither being needy and grasping, nor being aloof and arrogant and rejecting. When that connection comes about, we can beautify each other by making that connection beautiful. And when it's time for that connection to end, it ends. And that's all. Now, in this monastery, Santi Monastery, and I've been here since the beginning, and I've set it up, and my own preferences have largely shaped physical landscape and how we practice and so on here. And one of the things that means is that monastery is mainly orientated towards seclusion. We sort of tend to that side. Why? Well, only because that's what I like. I set it up, so bad luck if you don't like it. So we can't change a monastery for every person who comes here. But that's how I want to live. I love being in seclusion. I love being by myself. And I have to be frank. I never actually want to be with people. If I was just to be by myself all the time, I'd be perfectly happy. Couldn't remember the last time when I actually felt like I really wanted to spend time with people. Of course I'm happy to do it when I do it. It's not a problem for me. But it's not something that I miss or that I long for. In my monastic life I've spent long periods of time in isolation. And I was perfectly happy. Didn't miss anything. Be perfectly happy to do it again. So some monasteries, of course, they tend to emphasize the community aspect of things more. And we were just talking with Ayeshe the other day about the practice at Palm Village, where they have raised that community practice to quite a beautiful art. I've never been there, but I've heard many good things about the community there. And so, obviously, a lot of people find that beneficial, and that's a terrific thing. But we can't try to do everything, can we? We can only try to do what we're good at here and what this place is for. So this is just, I think, as much as anything else, is just a personality thing. Everywhere we go, there will be some seclusion and some connection and communication, and the balance and emphasis will shift from place to place. And what is right will shift from person to person and from time to time. There's no one right way of doing things. But it is important to understand that if we stay here, that this is what we're here to do. That these are the kinds of connections that we want to make. That in order to be able to live together as a community, there has to be that that trusting, that care. But that comes without the grasping and the attachment. That's the fine balance, but that's what we have to do. And so this, again, just to come back to that question of the why in some cases that the monks have a problem living like that. You know, there's always a fear in that I've felt myself and also seen in others. Fear of women, fear of the feminine in the monks manifests as a rejection, pushing away, that we've all seen so clearly in this past year. But imagine if we were to really take that practice very seriously, and that if we were to see women as our sister, then what is there to fear? Are we going to get into a sexual relationship with our sister? Again, this comes back to the taboo on incest, the most primal boundary in human relationships, the most basic boundary in human relationships. If we're really developing that loving kindness, developing that respect, developing that trust that one has with a beloved sister, then who is there to see as an object of lust? One's mind would be horrified by that. You'd turn away from it. Be so ashamed to have a thought like that of one's sister. So this is how we should develop and how we should try to practice in a monastery. And remember that this personal development, this development of ourselves as individuals, is not, it comes before our development of meditation. It's more basic than that. It's more primitive. This is primary school. Meditation is university or postgrad. So let's study what we need to study for primary school. Make sure that that's done right and don't expect to be able to graduate from university if we fail in primary school. So this is my little talk for you this evening on personal development and gender. Questions? And any comments or questions from the audience?
Actually, I think the way some transparent monks reject women has to do with their own fear of desire. But I think it's a significant fear, you know. It's not easy to think of a woman as a sister. And you know, if the desire is quite significant, then it's kind of dangerous. So one can't just impose thoughts, she's my sister, she's my sister. You know, what can one do when one's overwhelmed by desire? That's why they avoid us, I think, sometimes. And I've actually felt a bit monstrous, like I really felt like they didn't want us there because they saw us as objects of temptation.
Of course.
And I could feel that aversion, you know, and made me feel bad about myself.
Yeah.
So, like it was my fault, you know. But, yeah. And I also know that it can happen the same for women. So.
Of course, yeah. Oh, you know, always have a cold shower or whatever. So yes, of course it's an issue, yeah, and that's why it's a long term sort of complex developmental thing. So it's not that it's not an issue; it obviously is, and that's not easy, and that's why I stress, like, in for ordinary development, that's why you know to develop this perception of non-lover around your mother. Takes all of those initiation rituals and all of those things. Takes a lot of work to actually do it. So it's not something that just happens. So yeah, that's something that needs to be done.
How to work with that kind of very strong desire? It's probably the biggest significant factor in people disrobing, apart from sexism
and other things. Well, yeah, I guess that's it could be a whole another talk, but I mean, that's, you know, if it's just, you know, on a short term level, then of course there's all those many different practices and so on which, you know, can be done to quell the flames, you know, doing asubha contemplation and all of these kinds of things. There's many different practices which are involved in it.
I have a comment. When I first went to a monastery for a long stay, there was actually a beautiful young woman there, 23 years old, very attractive, and about a month into the retreat, 3 weeks, I started talking to her actually. And I was telling her about how I initially sort of actually viewed her. So my first thought when I came there was to treat her like she was invisible. And I would sex her straight. And when I said that, she just couldn't sort of stop. She said, I'm glad you didn't talk to me like that at all. You know, she was, I feel who she was, but her idea of just being treated like she didn't exist. She just couldn't sort of restrain that hurt. And then I also mentioned that, you know, doing Zuba contemplation, as she was the object, and she was also visibly nonplussed about that. But I didn't really have a choice. but you see, because I actually was talking to her, though, I was putting trust there, and also trust with these things. And that was definitely the right approach. And all she really wanted was like a friend or a brother. She'd done a much better job of cultivating the sister mind, I managed to do brother mind. But for me, it was very re-educational to put aside those attitudes of, you know, sensuous rage and so on, and to relate as a person.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing was actually where it had come from. weird idea of like ignoring who it come from. That was just a sort of hazy, you know, attitude to pervade these places. It's what you mean to do. There's really nothing stronger than that. I mean, there was some issues in myself. Mainly this attitude, this is the right thing to do. It was holding me back from trying to develop a more mature relationship until I sort of saw through that.
Yeah, I think that is an important thing, which actually sounds very basic, but just to come back to your question, Ayesha, is just talking to people, actually. And then you realize that they're actually a mind, not just a body. And that's in a basic way that we learn to relate to people.
What about the passage in Mahabharata Sutta? When Ananda asks the Buddha, how should he deal with women? That passage is always a bit jarring to me. What would you think about it?
Well, number one thing, that's Ananda, whose escapades with women are many and hilarious. somewhat more to the point, it's not found in any of the Sanskrit or Chinese versions. So it's clearly a later interpolation. Yeah, and it's not found anywhere else in the suttas. Ananda's spoken to the Buddha shortly before the Buddha passes away, and they're talking about various other things, and then all of a sudden Ananda just pops up completely out of context and says, what do we do about women? And the Buddha says, don't see them. And he says, well, what if I do see them? And then he says, well, don't look at them. And he says, well, what if I do see them? Sorry, don't talk to them. He says, what if I do talk to them? He says, well, be mindful, Ananda.
Is it maybe a teaching specifically for him?
Well, I think it's a teaching which was given in the certainly it's a passage which is in the context of Ananda's relationships to women in general. There's no doubt about that. But that idea, don't see them. That's not sense restraint. And that's not what the Buddha taught anywhere else is sense restraint. In fact, that's specifically what he says in the Indriya Bhavana Sutra is not sense restraint. Right? Not seeing things. Seeing things means sense restraint means you're mindful of what you see and watch over your mind. So it's guarding your response to things rather than just avoiding them.
Do you think that this is not done in the Chinese sutras? We will talk this sutra and move into Chinese.
Look, it's certainly not in the Sanskrit version. My understanding is it's not in the Chinese versions of that. But I may be wrong. It may be found in some versions and not in others. Yeah. Or it could have been something that's been adopted from the Pali. I'm not sure. Or it could be that it's somewhere else in the Chinese. I'm not 100% sure. Yeah.
What sutra is it that the Buddha talks about? Sister, mother,
mind. It's in the Anguttara somewhere. Can't remember exactly.
What about mental development? Like the Brahmas, they have no gender. And that's equivalent to samadhi, I guess. So if we're trying to get there, should we try to, whatever gender we are, try to bring the qualities of the other gender into our own mind?
Right. And that's the integration thing, and that's the, if we came from a Jungian point of view, they're called the anima or the animus. So, and again, that's why I mentioned that thing about like the sister for the men, the sister of the woman, the brother, something which is always present. So it's like it's eternal in the sense that there's always, the sister is always there with you at every stage of life and development, or at least an idea. So there's a kind of reflection. I would agree very much so that's a very strong part of that process of samadhi is being able to integrate those.
So how can this be done in practice?
are in many different ways. But you know, if you look at the qualities that are developed in developing meditation, then it's always through this kind of the balance and the integration of all of these different qualities. So this essentially is what we're doing.
Yeah,
of course, you
may. Some people say, you know, the thing they themselves is not to measure themselves how they practice. And if we're talking about thinking for the patient, that is the standard from the top for practicing Buddhism. If we don't have a precept, don't have something that tell you exactly what you're going to do. Just think like a vine like this. They don't have this love to cultivate the goodness in themselves. So I think like a precept, actually in Buddhism they emphasize in all body, speech and mind. If they talk about that, think about our sister, our brother. So they still say, okay, we go together, work together, get close together. We are sister, brother. But they don't have this don't have this cultivate to be like a lover or lust coming up in themselves, and they tell everybody that we are sister, brother. We think about that. And we don't have the way to practice like a body, speech and mind, they miss up. Those, I think, the basics of monastic, they have to keep peace at the first. The first thing, to think about it. That Andre taught is the wisdom that the one who mature already, but the one who don't have a Buddhist background, they don't mature that way. They still immature. They need something more to keep their wisdom to think about that.
Yeah, you raise a good point. Because in my case, it was the fact that both myself and this woman were following 8 precepts that gave me the confidence to actually interact with her. So I thought, well, we both agreed to follow these precepts. That means neither of us are going to try anything. So it gave me grounds of confidence in myself. And it was well founded as well.
I was thinking that if it's so easy as to imagine that a relationship between two genders can just be seen as brotherly and sisterly relationship, probably Buddha wouldn't have come up with so many precepts, you know, in the Vinaya to help keep us, you know, in line with pure practices. If it's so simple as what it seems to be, just, you know, consider the other person as my brother or sister. I feel that it's not so simple as Ayesha was mentioning. If that was the case, then there wouldn't be so many cases of a monastic disrobing just to get married, either amongst monastics themselves or laity with monastics and all those things. So I cannot agree that it can be so simple as to just consider any relationship as something which is sisterly or brotherly. I mean, I think there's a word called, is it platonic relationship? There is such a thing. But I think a platonic relationship also probably has certain kind of external forms that one can probably read more easily against one that has some, I would say, clinging and attachments on the deeper side. I'm speaking from the perspective of having married, having fallen in love myself. I have two children who are married. I have seen how they are when they are, you know, in love, so-called in love. Yeah. So I think it's very difficult to just tell each other that we are brother and sister, and that everybody has to take it for granted that this pair of person are like brother and sister. If they are, of course, there's no harm. But if they are not, then we are like, you know, reinforcing certain misconception in them. And I feel that that is quite dangerous in monastic life. So we have to be very, very careful. I mean, I'm speaking from my own point of view. Yeah? Because I come from a college where there are 200-300 people living together. Such things happen. This banism happens, and all those things. It happens all the time. Despite all the precautions, despite how, you know, the Chinese monastics, our disciplinarian monastics are very strict, our abbots very strict, everybody has to keep apart, but all these things still happen. So, I still feel that as monastics, we have to be very, very careful. It's better to have prevention rather than the cure.
I think you also have to be extra careful because everyone's watching this monastery waiting for it to fail because they believe that men and women can't live together, especially in Theravada.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of conservative Asian supporters. Yeah. So we have to work extra hard to kind of not make it a horrible place where men and women avoid each other, but to just make sure that everyone is ethical. Because you want to show that it can be done and that people can rise above their primitive instincts and relate to each other as human beings. I guess it's also useful to look at your own feelings as well, yeah? Then you can measure what you're capable of and what you're really feeling. And to know that you're in too deep and you might need to pull back.
That in the Chinese monasteries where there's so many restrictions and it still happens, is there a way to prevent it at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Preventive measures are there, but this thing can happen. So imagine if there is no preventive measure, then we are trying to encourage.
Maybe it just happens anyway.
Yeah. So the most important is for the monastics ourselves, we have to be quite aware of our own feelings and of course our ethics and other aspects.
I think it works quite well at Plum Village because they have they have some time together, but they also have time where it's just the monks and just the nuns separately as well. And amongst the nuns, there's sisterhood; amongst the monks, there's brotherhood, and therefore no one's lonely looking for affirmation from the opposite gender, because they feel complete, like they're in almost like a family environment. They feel noble friendship within their own community. And therefore that is a great deterrent to seeking the other kind of intimacy. So they have some time together, but they also have time apart where they're just with people of their own gender. You certainly want to avoid the other model, which is in the Thai monasteries where women feel like they're lepers.
it's what I call toxic woman syndrome, because women are toxic and you go near them and you get contaminated and develop with these diseases. So you've got to keep it 10 meters. The same thing really is that way sometimes.
Okay. actually, it's also something I keep talking going on and on, but it's an interesting subject. But I think it's also really wonderful for women to be able to learn from monks, because monks have been holding the tradition for a long time. And I think something is lacking often in Theravada when women set up their communities without having had formal training. So when nuns can live near monks and see all the things that they do and embody the tradition, then when they do, you know, if they do set up their own community, they'll be on the right path. They'll have that strong root that they've received from their monastic brothers, and they definitely did need the help of the monks to do that, to establish that.
Okay, so thank you everyone for your comments. Let's finish by paying respects.
Sufapipanno, Bhagavata.